Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, what if community college was free, not just for young adults, but for everyone? Tennessee is about to find out what it will mean for their economy, their overall higher ed rates, and their quality of life. Here's how it works. If you don't have an associate's degree and you want one, your tuition is covered. So why doesn't Minnesota and every state follow Tennessee's lead? Three roundtablers and your view via social media. If community college was free at any point in your life, just out of high school or right now, how do you think it would change your education and career prospects? Daydream a little bit. Think practically about this. And talk to me about it on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Our roundtablers today, Brian Rosenberg is with us, president of McAllister College. Great to have you back, Brian. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tim Wines is president of Inverhills Community College and Dakota County Technical School. Tim, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Carrie.
And Antoinette Flores is senior policy analyst at the Center for American Progress. She's joining us today from Washington, D.C. And Antoinette, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tim, Tennessee already has free community college for high school graduates. And I have to say, as I looked into the numbers, one result of that is that they are seeing record numbers of students entering community college. Isn't that all we need to know to say every state ought to follow their lead?
Gee, Carrie, I don't think so.
Throw cold water all over this, Tim.
No, not
Why?
At all. It's not just that the students are entering. It's how they're entering, what the purpose is, and are they being retained by the schools? And one of the things that they've done at in Tennessee is they started a mentoring program. They do it through private providers. And in looking through the data before this interview this morning, I noticed that they had a huge number of turnovers in their mentoring programs. And so it seems to me Tennessee's still figuring it out. They're getting the students in. That's great if they're there for the right purpose. And if it's the students they intended to target, and that's the thing. So they're getting 16,000 more students. But are those students that would have gone to private colleges, to universities, or are those the students, the low-income students they wanted to get to begin with? And I don't think at this point in time the research tells us the answer to that.
One question when you said there's high turnover in the mentoring program. You mean among mentors?
Yeah, among mentors.
Okay,
well,
what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that the students, the idea was to attract students that wouldn't have gone to higher ed originally.
Right.
So we would have thought twice about it. And one of the floors of this program is, okay, we're going to provide a lot of intents and services. They don't have the money to do that on their own, so they're bringing in not-for-profits to provide mentors to these students. When the students come in, they get oriented well. They've got someone to talk to as they're making their way through the academic programming.
Which is good, right?
That's all super. It's terrific. If you're not trained to do that, if it's not natural for you, or if the people coming in and trying it once and walking away, the inconsistency of that for students, I think, is a really big issue. At our two colleges, we provide, and I'm sure this is true at McAllister, a lot of counseling and advising for students as they enter as freshmen, as first-year students, to make sure they're on track and they're oriented towards the higher education experience. We use professionals for that. It's to keep students in, it's tough. And even at the high level, it's a challenge, but especially for the community technical colleges, students that were not otherwise prepared for college, which is most of our students coming in, they need a lot of support to survive.
Antoinette, does Tim have the key question here? And this is how Tennessee and other states that are doing this are going to have to be measured. Are these students who would not be going to higher education at this point in their lives but for free access to community college? Is that the question?
I think that's a great question, a great place to start. In Tennessee, the jury is really still out. They first launched their Tennessee Promise Program in 2014, and that was intended to serve recent high school graduates. They just expanded to serve adult students, and I will say, from someone that follows higher education policy, Tennessee is really leading the nation here. And it's exciting to see a state focus on adult students. We haven't seen that yet, and it's really one of the places we need to focus if we're concerned about increasing college attainment levels. There are a couple questions that I would be interested in And the Tennessee Promise should be graduating its first cohort of students that have gone through the program.
Okay.
So a couple things we'll be looking for. One, how many of those students that entered remained in the program and were able to maintain eligibility? Two, how many of them actually complete? And three, what types of students are they serving? Are they reaching the students that they intended to? And given that Tennessee is continuing to experiment and build on this program, we'll be looking for similar things with adult students.
Brian, I guess I would ask, what does it matter if they're serving the types of students that Tim and Antoinette think they should be, as long as people are getting onto the path of higher education?
Well, it matters because there's a finite number of public dollars to spend on education. And when you invest those dollars, you really want to make sure that you're investing them in a way that provides maximal benefit to society and really gets at the populations that are most in need of help right now. So I'm actually more familiar with Oregon than I am with Tennessee. I believe Oregon started the Oregon Promise maybe a year later,
uh-huh.
and I've looked at some early data from that. And what they're seeing is that most of the financial benefit is going to students who are not among the poorest. So if you're a low-income student who qualifies for a Pell Grant, right now community college is, in fact, more or less free. So the students who are benefiting from this free community college are students who are above the level of Pell Grant eligibility. In other words, more affluent than our least affluent students.
Could be getting Pell Grants instead of just entering free. Is that what you're saying?
The students who qualify for Pell Grants now, in
uh-huh.
other words, the lowest income students, for many of those students, community college is already free.
Got it. Because they can get a Pell Grant.
Right.
Okay.
So the students in Oregon who are benefiting financially from this are students whose income is above the level of Pell Grant eligibility. In other words, more affluent students. So the question is, do we want to direct public dollars to providing subsidies to more affluent students who would otherwise probably be going to college anyway?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we want to direct those dollars where they're most needed, that is to populations that are currently being underserved and not going to college?
Here's what Republican Governor of Tennessee, Bill Haslam, said about this as they unveiled the new promise here. We are either going to give these kids a second chance now, or I don't know when we will. These kids keep getting left behind. Question mark around that for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, I'm not sure that that the way to do it is to make community college free for everyone, regardless of whether they fit into that category. I am all for directing our public dollars toward the students who have the greatest financial need. And the question for me is a policy like this accomplishing that? It is early, and so we only have 2 or 3 years of results for any of these programs. But the early results and common sense suggest to me that a lot of these dollars are going to go to students who are not in that group, but in fact are in higher economic brackets. What they're seeing in Oregon as well is declining enrollments at the four-year publics. So what it's telling them is that students who otherwise would have gone to a four-year public are going to a community college because it's free. That's not increasing
access.
You're
pooling from the same pool,
exactly.
Is what you're saying. Tim, that's something I think you suggested at the beginning here.
Right, and I don't think that's incorrect at all. To me, the issue is, first of all, the word free is just insulting. I mean, that wasn't not the way Brian was using it, but calling it free community college, a couple things about that. When we tell students that it's free, it makes it seem like there's no value to it, and that's just wrong. It's a scholarship, something that says that you've got to put something into this because it's taxpayer money. Someone's paying for it. In Tennessee, they're doing it with lottery money, which is, to me, a really questionable way to finance anything.
Okay. Two things to come back to here,
right.
but keep going.
But they've been successful in doing that so far, and they've introduced Reconnect, which I'm assuming Antonia is going to talk about, which is a great idea for getting adults engaged. But when we tell students it's free, one, that's not true. It's Pell dollars, it's taxpayer dollars, and then if that's covered tuition fees, there's still living expenses. And most of our students, if you walked into either one of my community technical colleges, Dakota County Technical College or Infra Hills, and asked students, do they work, every hand goes up. Are you taking out as much as you can in terms of the financial aid plus perhaps a loan? Most hands go up. So for our students, it's a significant financial investment, no matter what the circumstance, because beyond the tuition and fees, which is what these cover, tuition and fees, and they're what's called last dollar programs, which means, which is what Brian was referencing earlier, they don't necessarily draw the student in that they're intended for, because if the student gets Pell Grants, they're maxed out there for their tuition and fees. In fact, they may even get a refund for that to cover their books. They don't get the promise money because they've essentially got their tuition and fees covered. But if you're a student that didn't qualify for Pell, you're in. And that's not the student. I mean, that's my kids. That's not who they're aiming for.
Antoinette, I want to come back to what Tim said about calling it free and not from the, well, there are expenses that you're going to have to undertake, just the value idea of that. I think if you're interested in going to college, you already acknowledge the value of getting that higher education. And whether we call it free or not doesn't matter that much. What would you say?
I would say that the word free is really compelling to students and families. The cost of college has grown astronomically. And while I would prefer that our public dollars prioritize those with the greatest need, I also acknowledge the fact that students a little bit higher up the income scale have a very hard time paying for a public four-year degree. And so I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that these students might be choosing community college. I do really think that there it's worth talking about living expenses, and they've already mentioned this, but all of the state free college programs so far have been last dollar, which means that a student's Pell Grant goes first. And the state makes up the difference, and we're only talking about tuition there. But one of the biggest costs that students face, and it's oftentimes far greater than tuition, comes from living expenses. If I don't have reliable transportation, I can't get to class. If I don't have childcare, if my rent is not covered, a college education might be out of the question. And so as we see these programs grow, I would hope that at some point they do consider living expenses and some of the barriers that come with that.
All right. Brian, do you think it diminishes the value, the ideal of higher education to call it free?
Well, you know, the messaging is important. I would prefer a word that was different from free simply because it does suggest that someone is not paying for this, and someone is always paying for it. It's a little bit, to me, like the argument that students shouldn't borrow at all to get an education, debt-free. I think it's created the impression among a lot of people that there's something wrong or unwise about borrowing for higher education, when in fact, if you talk about borrowing for any reason, it's probably the best investment, best financial investment you can make.
Mm-hmm.
So the impression is that these words do create on people matter. I'm less focused on the word than I am on maximizing the impact of our public investments. There's no doubt that there are some benefits to any of these programs for some people, but we live in a world of choices. And my preference would be to maximize the benefit for those who currently don't have those benefits. And I'm simply not convinced that these various free programs, whether it's free community college or New York State's free public college program, that they're directing the finite public dollars we have to the students who most need them.
So what's the better way to get at that population? If you are right, and again, this is early days here on what's going on in Tennessee, at least, in Oregon, what's the better way to get to that population?
The better way is in my view, and obviously I'm invested in this because I run a private college, but something like the Minnesota State Grant Program, where the dollars go directly to students based on a need analysis. So students with a certain level of need get a certain level of financing. In that case, it's from the state. In the case of Pell Grant, it's from the federal government. Mm-hmm. And then they can use that money at whatever 2 or 4 year college, whatever technical or research university they choose to use it at.
What happens when states, as has happened in a lot of states, withdraw some of that money?
Then it devastates students,
well,
and it drives up costs. So really what we should be doing is adding to that pool of money at both the federal and the state level. Federal Pell Grants have not even come close to keeping up with the cost of education, the cost of inflation. And so more and more of that burden has fallen to the student.
Isn't that where, Tim, Tennessee, Oregon, some of these other programs step in? Because we're in the reality that state and federal funding is not supplying those funds to the level that they should.
Tennessee offers an interesting promise, to use their word. But it's not the question of whether they should be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
It's how and why it works. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that right
now.
Too
early?
3 years in.
Yeah.
There's a University of Pennsylvania study of all the promise programs. And they come back to that question over and over again, which is no one so far has researched the question, at least because they can't, to say how and why these programs work and whether they're bringing in the right kinds of students and doing what they said they were going to do. They're definitely increasing the pool, but it's at what cost and to whom, and does it address the population question? I don't disagree with Brian on one issue for sure. Targeted grants are not a bad thing. You know, the legislature has given in the state a couple of opportunities for the Minnesota state system. One's aimed at occupational areas where if you go into high school, high-wage areas, you can get a grant to go to our community technical colleges.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to go into those high-skill areas, so that essentially your education's free, but it's a grant to go in. It's saying it's scholarshiping to meet a workforce need, to meet an interest. And they're also have a workforce development program they're piloting in 2019 with us. That's sort of the same thing. And they also do a pilot program that starts next year on emergency grants for students that are in a one-time circumstance that's going to prevent them from continuing their education. Say their car is broken down, they can apply to a grant program through the Office of Higher Ed. Those kind of things, targeting a specific need or a specific purpose, to me seem to make a lot more sense in terms of being sustainable, because it's something directed towards the need of the state, plus the student matches up.
Antoinette?
Well, I would just focus a little bit on where we are politically. A couple of months ago, we were talking about federal-state partnerships that would reinvest substantially into our public colleges. But it's clear now that we are not going to have any leadership at the federal level on these issues. The president's budget proposed last month would actually roll back college affordability, would completely eliminate subsidized loans for undergraduates, would have federal work study, would cut other grants. The Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program would be completely eliminated. And so all eyes should be on the states, and given that many states have pulled funding from their public colleges over the past 10 years, I think any focus on reinvestment is promising.
Yeah, I mean, Brian, if you're a high school junior and you're living in a low-income family, and you're living in the reality of where we're at right now, as Antoinette says, where the budget is, the federal budget is, and what we know the history of the state has been, you need something now, or you need something to be there in the next couple of years. You can't hope that some of these programs get funded to the point that, you know, where it's going to make a difference for you.
And it's clear that the simplicity of free community college might in fact get through to some of those students and encourage them to pursue education beyond high school, and that would be a good thing. The reality is that for a lot of those low-income students, there are financial support system in place now, both mm-hmm. through the state grant and through Pell Grants. A lot of our problem has to do with getting the right information to the right students at the right time. One of the things we know in Minnesota is that in our public schools in the Twin Cities, we have about the lowest ratio of counselors to students of any school system in the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's an embarrassment. And so a lot of our problem is that these students are not getting the right information at the right time, so that they don't even realize that they can afford college, whether it's a community or technical college or a four-year college, if they just take advantage of the programs that are available. So free is simple. It might get the message across. It might encourage some of those students to think about college. At the end of the day, it still concerns me deeply that a lot of the actual dollars are not going to go to those students because it is as all of your guests have said it's last dollar in. So if they qualify for a Pell Grant and a state grant, there's a pretty good chance they're going to get $0 out of a free community college program.
You're listening to a roundtable conversation here about higher education, taking note of something that Tennessee has recently announced. They've got the Tennessee Promise, where they provide what they call free community college to students in the state. And now they've added Tennessee Reconnect, where they make community college available to adults as well. And I want to talk with our guests specifically about that. Brian Rosenberg with us, president of McAllister College. Tim Wines, president of Inver Hills Community College and Dakota County Technical College. And Antoinette Flores, a senior policy analyst at the Center for American Progress. She's with us today in a studio in D.C. And I'm asking you, as you listen in and you follow along the conversation here, if community college was free at any point in your life, just out of high school, given acknowledging what we've said about some expenses will be yours, or as an adult, as right now, how do you think it would change your education and your career prospects? So I want you to be practical about this. What kind of a difference might it make in the way you're planning out your life and your career? Talk to me about it on Twitter. It's at Kerri, KerriMPR. Antoinette, to you about now let's talk about Tennessee's Reconnect program here as far as who the population that they're going to target here with making this available to adults. Are other states doing this, or is this one of a kind? And what do we know so far about the prospects of this?
I would say for the most part, it's one of a kind. When states are offering state aid, frequently they have limits on it that do not allow the money to go to adult students, and so that makes it difficult. Not only that, but adult students face greater barriers. They have to maintain a household, often a job, care for dependents. And so if we want to address college attainment, then I think a renewed focus on these adult students is a great thing.
And so you don't have the same kind of concerns about, are we also targeting the kind of population that we want to go after that have been raised when we're talking about younger students?
I do have that concern to some degree, because my hope is that we have more students who otherwise would not access college, going to college. But among adult students, it's a little bit of a different story.
And Tim, is it a different story in your view?
It is. I'd be interested, Antoinette, that's the policy wonk. Do you know if Reconnect has the same barriers to it that the original Tennessee Promise has in terms of
mentoring?
And also in terms of the income. If you're working and your work income counts towards your tuition, in other words, it counts in your EFC, and it you become higher or lower based on that in terms of your contributions expected to the college, does that affect the ability for an adult to get the full amount of Tennessee Promise?
I'm not entirely sure on the details of it. My understanding was things like the mentoring did not apply.
Anything that gets adults back into the college, I think, is a good thing if they've got a specific purpose for being there. Just as an example, Scott County over Shakopee Savage, that area of the area, has a really high level of people with some college but not a degree.
Uh-huh.
We have a center over there in Burnsville nearby Scott County that's trying to attract those students. It is hard to figure out schedules for them, their workplace, how they finance higher ed. They've been out a while, so they often have to get their math and writing skills back up to speed. It's a challenge, and it's not easy for them. And you really have to be cognizant of just a number of factors, mostly, which is that they have wives independent of being a student. And there's the cost and everything else that goes with it. So it's a tough nut to crack. But if you can find a way to make all those things work, and if it's one more thing, finances are the biggest barrier by a mile. If you can reduce that barrier, you're going to get them in.
Isn't this also something, Tim, that your organization is acknowledging, which is that many, many people who come into community college don't end up getting an associate's and don't end up getting a four-year degree? I mean, in some ways, you're taking responsibility for this as well.
Yes. Some of our students don't enter with that as their goal. It's a certificate. It's a skill level attainment. But I'm also talking to the student that's maybe did a year at Mankato,
yep,
a year at the U, dropped out for a variety of reasons, and now they want to go back to school. and they've got kids, they've got a mortgage. How am I going to make this happen? But if I'm going to move up in the workforce, I need to do this. The other part of this thing is the workforce that pays $10 to $15 an hour. If you're two people living on that, you don't have any kids, you're doing okay. It's not a career, it's a job. But it's really hard to entice those folks back to school to say, give up a little bit of your income and think long term about what you're going to do, because what you're at right now is just a job. It's not a career.
Brian?
Yeah, my question would be, and I genuinely don't know what they're doing in Tennessee on this, is whether they're making appropriate investments in the community college system itself to handle all of these new students. It's one thing simply to say, all right, it's going to be free. You all go ahead and enroll. But as Tim said, not only are these additional students, this is a different population with particular challenges. And I don't care whether you're the University of Minnesota or a community college. Anytime you bring into a college environment students whose background is different, you need to spend a lot of time thinking about how to serve those students. You need to make sure you have the people. You need to make sure you have the resources. Imagine a community college system like our own. That is already working overtime trying to serve the students that it has, that faces students with all kinds of challenges, and just dumping into that system a whole new large population of students without providing the appropriate resources. That's my fear.
Can I ask you what your four-year graduation rate is at McAllister?
The four-year graduation rate is between 85 and 90%.
Okay.
And 60%.
Okay. And Antoinette, are we hearing that's in general, if you look across higher ed, 60% community college, which seems actually higher than the usual?
It is. It is higher
okay.
than average.
And
60% is a really great result for a community and technical college.
Antoinette, is that typical?
That's not typical. I would say that's exceptional for community colleges, but we also have a very difficult time measuring this because some of our federal data only includes first-time, full-time students, which
okay.
does not apply to a majority of community colleges. And so we don't really have a great federal graduation rate on these schools. And often the community colleges themselves have a much better sense.
And that's an important distinction, Carrie. At Inverhills and North Hennepin, for example, 60% of my students at Inverhills are part-time students. North Hennepin is 80%. But the technical colleges, the vast majority of students are full-time because
okay.
they're in cohorts that have a very specific schedule. They work their way through and they graduate. You either stay with it or you don't. And so the tech schools tend to up a little bit on the graduation level
Got
because
it.
The students are committed to it.
Is this a group of students, though, Tim, that community colleges have for too long kind of, and I don't want to say washed your hands of, but said, look, we're focused on getting you into community college. It's your job to figure out how to stay there. And that wasn't enough.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's true in the past. I know both of my colleges were very intentional about advising and counseling. And we just got a Title III grant from the federal government this year to work specifically with adult students, targeting the populations we're talking about with Tennessee Connect.
Uh-huh.
But that goes back to the patchwork framework of higher ed. We're doing that with a federal grant that we get for 5 years, but that program may go away after that. We have another program called Tuition Match Minnesota at Inverhills and a few other community colleges where students are, if they earn $900, put it in a bank account, and we match it with federal money and a foundation money, it pays for a semester of college. But that program's going to go away under Secretary DeVos's budget. So it's a patchwork of things. We have a couple things in the state that work. We have the state grant, you have Pell. It's all sort of mixed together. And for a student coming in that doesn't know anything about this,
right.
it's tough to navigate. Back to Brian's point about counselors.
Right, right. And I didn't pursue that, and I want to. How much of a difference does that make, Antoinette, to have the kind of counseling, the guidance counseling to students, particularly in low-income families where maybe nobody has been to college before, to have that kind of information not just available, but being transmitted by somebody in high school, you know, at the sophomore, junior, even before that level?
It makes a really big difference. And I think it's an area that does not get enough attention in our K-12 schools and our high schools. It can make a really big difference because this is a system that is very difficult to navigate. You have to navigate not only the institution itself, the patchwork of aid, filing for the federal filing for federal student aid in and of itself can be a barrier. So it really matters that we have people in our high schools prepared to help students choose the right decision for them.
One more bit of context here on keeping students in school. I was looking at a report from 2015, found that only 39% of students who enter community college end up with a degree 6 years later. 25% of the students who enroll in the fall don't show up again for classes in the spring. So this actually does show that your results are exceptional, Tim.
Well, the 39%, that probably is pretty true for this reason. Two things. If they don't take into account that the student intended to transfer to a four-year school.
Okay.
A lot of our students come, there's the Minnesota transfer curriculum. You get 40 hours in, you can transfer to the U. That's not considered completion. So those students don't count for us. The second one are students that come in with a very specific skill attainment concept, which is different than
a four-year
college.
This is what you said on the certificate?
Yeah. It's, you know, when I went to school like McAllister, I went to one in Iowa, you know, I'm there to get a BA. That's not true for our students necessarily. So the data from the feds on completion is always a little bit of a mixed bag, but the bottom line is there are a lot of students that don't finish, and that's not a good thing.
Brian?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think our community colleges are doing an extraordinary job with a very difficult challenge. I mean, it is the backbone of our system. More students are in these institutions than are in any other kind of institution. They come in with enormous challenges. A substantial portion of the work that's done, not just at community college, but in the whole Minsky system, is remedial work. This is work that is being done just to get the students up to the level where they should be starting college. So it's not surprising that the graduation rates are not higher. So anything that would invest in the quality and the resources in these institutions, I am all for. My concern is just providing them with more students, mm-hmm. But not providing them with more resources, more help. And, you know, as Tim said, it's a patchwork. It's inconsistent. We're in an awful environment right now in terms of the potential for increased federal support. So simply adding students to an already overstretched system seems to me to be not a good policy decision.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable as we talk about higher education investment, some of the programs within states and the city of Chicago to offer free access to community colleges, how to bring more adults. This is something Tennessee is experimenting with, to bring adults back to community college to complete their educations. We've asked a group of roundtablers from the education community to join in and have a discussion about this. Tim Wines is with us, president of Inverhills Community College and Dakota County Technical College. Antoinette Flores with us for the Center for American Progress, and Brian Rosenberg, president of McAllister College. I just want to come back to something, Tim, that Brian said about remedial classes, which, as he phrased it, it's basically preparing you to be ready for college. Why do community colleges have to do so much of that?
And we call it developmental ed because we're not going backwards to high school. We're moving them towards college. And
okay.
The reason is that 40% of our students come in and they cannot read and write at the college level, and 80% cannot do college math.
How'd they get out of high school?
That's a great question, isn't it? I don't know the answer to that.
I have a feeling you have some opinions on that, though.
I do, and I think we have a great system here in Minnesota. We moved here for the education system, but it's tough. And you have to consider the mix of students out of high school and also adult students. For adult students coming back to school, we talk about barriers for adults. To be told that you're going to have to take some developmental ed courses to be able to succeed in your regular college courses, it's a little insulting sometimes.
I'm sure.
And so
sure.
You have to work that through. And also tell them, by the way, you know, if you transfer to a four-year college, these aren't going to transfer. Those are all tough things. Let me just say this. It's not just us, though. It's not just community college students. When I talk, I've spent a lot of time as a president in Iowa, and we have some very good private schools down there as well. And the common refrain I heard all the time was, we're getting the students that you used to get. We're getting students that come in and can't do these things either. So you look at colleges like Grinnell, not necessarily Grinnell on the high end, but schools that are at that level that are offering first-year programs to make sure their students can read, write, and do math at the college level. Not necessarily nearly the work that we have to do, but it's not uncommon now that's affecting everything. And when the College of General Education was at the U, where anybody could get in and they could do that, that was what they were doing. They were doing developmental ed.
Hmm.
When they got rid of that, they decided those students were students they didn't want anymore. So for us, the big issue is to get those students matched up. And we do learning communities in Inverhills. So students are in a regular college course program, and they're also in a developmental program, for usually for writing. And they're developing those skills while they're also getting college credit in a psych course, a social course, or a lit course. And the teachers team together to move those students through. But those are small cohorts, require an intense mm-hmm. amount of mentoring for the student.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's tough, and because they're being thrown into a situation they weren't ready for. And if they survive and do well, which they mostly do because it's small and it's intense and the teachers are very, very good at this, they move forward pretty fast. But it's work to convince students.
But if you're the student and it's like you're going to pay for these classes and this is all just preparation to get to the next thing and they're not going to transfer, oh, my gosh, that would be very dispiriting.
It is. And, you know, we have a challenge sometimes in Minnesota being honest about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hear a lot of people say, well, if you look at the average high school performance test scores in Minnesota, we look pretty good, but averages can conceal a lot. And what it conceals mostly in Minnesota is an enormous race-based and income-based achievement gap.
Right.
And so if you're a kid who goes to a well-financed suburban high school in Edina, mostly white, you're going to have counselors, and you're going to get college prep, and you're going to probably come out pretty ready to go and be successful in a four-year college. If you are a student of color in the Minneapolis or St. Paul public schools, you're going to get an entirely different experience. That's where you have one counselor per every 800 students. And so if you break down our numbers and look at the achievement levels of white students and students of color, the gap is among the largest in the country.
And Antoinette, as Brian says, and this is something that if you've lived in Minnesota for a while and you follow education policy, you know well. But while our gap is very wide, you will find this in a lot of other states and school districts in the country, won't you?
That's correct. It's a big problem. And I think one of the issues here is that there are very few states that have alignment between the requirements to get out of high school and then to get into college.
Ah,
and so
interesting.
These courses don't always necessarily align, and it's something that I think that we need to address. But remediation is a big problem for students because it means that they're paying for a course that doesn't count towards a degree. And so when we talk about completion, students that have to take remediation have much lower completion rates than other students.
So if you're coming in and you need what Tim calls education development courses, you're even cutting back on your chances of ending up with that degree at
Correct.
The end of this.
Correct.
Wow. Even on top of all the other obstacles you may encounter as a student.
That's right.
Brian, I want to give you a chance on the soapbox here mm-hmm. about Minnesota and investment. Mm-hmm. Again, I mean, this is not – Minnesota doesn't stand alone in the way it's pulled back on investment for higher education. But have your say, please, on this.
Well, there are certain things about Minnesota that are distinctive, both positive and negative. One of the real positives in this state is we have a very educated population, and we have a very diverse knowledge-based economy. And that economy relies on an educated workforce. We also know we're not a state, because of where we're located, that can rely on importing lots and lots of people from other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to educate our own. And every data point that I've seen, and I'm part of the Itasca project, we've looked at this endlessly. Every data point suggests that we are now entering into a period where we're going to have a dramatic shortage within the state of sufficiently educated workers. We cannot continue this level of economic growth unless we educate more of our own people. And as the state becomes more diverse, that means educating populations that we're not currently serving. So this is, forget about social justice, which is important. This is pure self-interest. Unless we figure out a way to educate successfully a higher percentage of the students we are not now educating, the economy of the state and the quality of life for all of us will suffer. And I have not seen, really from anybody in politics, the political will really to make this investment.
Just one word on that before I go back to Tim. I mean, if you're the CEO of General Mills, we have a lot of Fortune 500 and some big Fortune 100 companies here. This is something you really care about as you look at the vibrancy of your company, right?
Right. And they will, and those CEOs are the ones sitting around the table at Itasca. They will say that. The problem is, and I'm sympathetic to the challenge of being the CEO of a large public company. They've got a lot of things they need to think about. And what they think about most is their shareholders. And so they also think about things like tax cuts. And so they're trying to balance the priority of investing in education against the priority of cutting their corporate taxes. And sometimes you'll get the same CEOs writing letters endorsing both of those things. Mm-hmm. And the governor or someone in the state legislature will look at that and say, well, you know, give me a break. You can't do both.
Right.
So they know this. They believe it. But maybe they're not in a position to get up quite as high on a soapbox as I am.
Tim, you said you think part of this is because there is no political price to pay.
Right.
For defunding higher ed.
When I was a president in Iowa, then Governor Tom Vilsack, who was Secretary of Agriculture first, President Obama once said to a group of college presidents, until there's a price to be paid politically for not funding you, we won't do it. He goes, my staff will be angry for me for saying that, but that's the truth. And he says, so figure out how to make us do it. And we used students there. We used students and businesses, and we had nowhere near the economic force that we have here in the Twin Cities. And we got them to turn around. But that's the thing. I mean, Governor Dayton, his heart's in the right place. The legislature, their heart's in the right place. They're trying to make it education affordable, accessible for Minnesotans. But in reality, there's no price to be paid if they don't do that.
Antoinette, I think given what Tim just said and you said earlier about the state of the president's budget, that appears to be the case in Washington as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Minnesota is probably a little bit better situated than some of the other states. You don't have to look any further than the state of Illinois, which hasn't passed a budget in 2 years and is now watching its public colleges crumble under the pressure. It's losing students to other states. It's losing businesses, and its population is declining. So this will have an impact for a long time to come, and I think sends a clear message to states that they need to invest. But this is also why you see governors, mayors, and legislators on both sides of the aisle, Democrat, Republican, looking at solutions like free college.
I'm really glad you brought that up because I didn't want to end without talking about the Chicago STAR program. And this is something Mayor Rahm Emanuel is very proud of. He just gave a speech on this. When you look into the details of the program, it has merit requirements, and this is from a report on the program. Students must have a high school GPA of 3.0 and need no remediation in math or English to qualify. Only an estimated 3,000 of the city's roughly 20,000 high school graduates would qualify. Tim, would you say he's not reaching the population they really need to?
It sounds like a real STAR program for those students. Yeah. Good for them. That's not an answer.
What and why?
Because those students are going to do well. They're going to go to college. They're going to do well anyway. Good for them. But those other 19,000 students, what's in it for them?
Brian?
I agree. It's targeting the population that needs the least help.
How can a city, let's say, Antoinette makes an excellent point about where Illinois is and haven't had a budget in years. How can a city make a difference in this in light of, again, the political environment that they exist in?
The one thing I would say about the Chicago STAR program, you know, when these free college programs come up, the first thing we always ask is it first dollar, is it last dollar? So far, we have not really seen a state go for first dollar. But mm-hmm. the second question that comes up is what are the limitations that are put on students, and there's been a lot of pushback on New York's plan because it has limitations of its own. But the one thing that makes the Chicago STAR program different from any of the others is that it also allows undocumented students to gain access to the program. And mm-hmm. so when you look at some of the impacts that it's had, the majority of students that have benefited are undocumented. And I think that's a redeeming quality, but it's not serving a majority of the students.
Again, those undocumented students must meet these requirements, right?
Correct.
The 3.0 GPA and
correct.
No remedial education. Brian, what is a city to do if you're motivated the way Mayor Emanuel is in Chicago in a very difficult political environment?
I wish there were an easy answer to that. I think that with our higher education system being so fragmented, funding coming from so many different sources, if you're not getting appropriate levels of help from the federal government or from the state government, and people aren't willing to pay a price in terms of things like taxes, it's hard to know where the extra dollars are going to come from. I'm not a policy wonk when it comes to K-12 education. There are lots and lots of groups in Minnesota that are working on mm-hmm. that. If the answer were easy, they probably would have come up with it already.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people thinking about it. I don't have an easy answer.
Tim?
I don't either. I mean, it's not simple. Yeah, I think the part that Antoinette pointed out about the STAR program for undocumented students is huge. And we have a lot of I will tell you, there are a lot of students at both of my colleges that leave federal money on the table because they're afraid to apply for it because of the either first gen, second gen, and they still aren't sure their status or what their status might be under the current rules. And so they don't apply for Pell. They don't apply for anything. They pay everything in cash. And those students would be applicable for a lot of different they could apply for a lot of things. But that student population, which is growing in Minnesota, is getting left out.
It sounds like, to put a point on the conversation here, that the three of you have been saying we are in an exceedingly difficult environment for this necessity of bringing more people to higher education. Tim, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, it's just a tough environment all the way around for students especially. How are they supposed to know how this is all going to work and what's sustainable and what's going to be there the next day?
Antoinette, you'd agree with that? What would you add?
I would agree. I think, again, we aren't going to see any leadership on this from a federal level, but this matters to states. It matters to our economy. It matters to employers. It matters increasingly just to get a job. And so it's going to be on the states to really lead here.
Brian?
I would just expand it to say that we're in a tough moment in general, in the sense that I have never seen so much questioning of the extent to which we have responsibility as a society to help those in our society who are most vulnerable, whether it's in the area of education or healthcare or housing. There seems to be a pretty strong current of belief right now that we have very little obligation as a society to provide support for those people. And in my view, not only is that cruel, it's self-destructive, because a society that doesn't help its most vulnerable ultimately is a society that will weaken itself. So education is just part of a larger network of challenges that we face right now. It's a peculiar moment.
Antoinette, thank you very much for being with us on the roundtable.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tim and Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To have you here.